why we are here and what Vanderbilt University Divinity School is. It is part of one of the commitments of Vanderbilt University Divinity School to challenge homophobia, which is prevalent in our church and society. And we'll be dealing with the way in which lived religion of persons who come from various religious backgrounds, the way in which that lived religion is formed, sometimes deformed, but also sometimes reconstructed through the use of religion. Edward and I crossed paths at Divinity School at Boston University. We were both talking today about how we studied there and lived to tell the tale. And we think in some ways that's probably the case for all graduate students, but maybe more so for us than is often the case. We learned a lot. Edward's passion and interest in the disciplines of psychology and theology, I'm sure, will bring to bear a tremendous amount of insight for us today. So the way we'll proceed is Edward will speak. I told you 30 or 40 minutes, that's probably true. And then we'll have some responses from Dr. John Sloot, Associate Professor in the Department of Communication here at Vanderbilt, and Professor Amy Jill Levine, Professor of New Testament and also Director of the Carpenter Program, who will give responses for 10 minutes, more or less. And then we'll have time for responses from you all as well. So would you join me in welcoming Dr. Edward Fonte?
Thank you very much. You know, the title doctor is so new to me. When people call me that, I still look around to see which doctor they're talking about. Even with my patients, sometimes it's very distracting for me. I see some of you out there who have already been through previous iterations of this talk in class or last night, so you really have a lot of stamina to listen to me go on about this more. But I appreciate you being here. It's very gratifying for anyone who spends a lot of time doing dissertation to find out that other people have interest in it and that it has a life beyond the defense. So thank you for being here. I thought what I would do would be briefly to frame the project that I undertook in my research to talk a little bit about sort of how it's shaped. And then I thought I would jump immediately to the results, because the results, I think, will interrupt your conversation about the psychological and theological aspects of it. At least I hope that they will. My decision to take on this project has a lot to do with the department that I come from, which exists at the axis or on the boundary between psychological and theological studies, and self-consciously tries to engage both those disciplines, which is a very hard thing to do, because for those of you who are in these disciplines, you might know that social sciences and psychology, which is of particular interest to me, does not typically engage theological studies. It's not particularly interested in the theological perspective and doesn't really have much ability to engage theological discourse. It's not, psychologists in general are not trained in that way, and it's very difficult to get a hearing for the theological perspectives in psychology and social sciences. There's a lot of interest in spirituality, and often it stops after that phrase, oh, we're interested in spirituality, and that's about as far as it goes. And we haven't quite figured out in psychology how to have this conversation with theology and religious studies. And that's part of what my department is working hard on and what I am working hard on. So I chose, even though my initial training is as a theologian, I chose to do an empirical psychological study as part of my research. It was really quite a stretch for me. And the reason for that is because I want to engage psychologists in the discipline of psychology, and I want to invite them even perhaps compel them to consider theological perspectives in their work. So the method that I chose is a cross-disciplinary method where I use both psychological perspectives on sexual minority religiosity, on the religious experience of sexual minority people, and theological perspectives together, bringing the perspectives together to have a conversation about what it means to be a sexual minority person of faith, and in particular, what it means to experience heterosexist stressors or have experiences of heterosexism that are rooted in religious language or ideas or symbols. What is the experience of those stressors? Now, this kind of work, this kind of project is, will falls within the realm of practical theology. Practical theology is a discipline of theology which attempts to look at the lived faith experience of certain kinds of people, certain religious communities, and tries to understand what kind of religious or theological ideas, or even what kind of divine revelation is unfolding in the context of the practice of communities of people living out their faith lives. So this is a practical theological project, or at least it aspires to be. So the first stage is to identify a problem, and then to identify the ways that people understand the problem, ways people respond to the problem, and then what are the general outcomes in people's faith lives. And that's the general end of the project. The problem that I identified was the experience of these kinds of heterosexual stressors as a kind of suffering. Suffering is a concept which is cross-disciplinary. Psychologists deal with suffering, and theologians deal with suffering, so the suffering, the concept of suffering can be discussed by both disciplines. And then I looked at the process by which people respond to problems, or to the experience of stress. So there's a problem, suffering. There's a way of understanding the problem, interpretation, interpreting the data of the suffering. There's a response to the suffering, and then there's outcomes. How are the lives of the people affected by this sequence of events? Suffering, interpretation, response. In order to begin to understand, to sort of frame up the empirical, the quantitative research that I was going to do, I spent a lot of time looking at what would be the areas, what would be the data already available about these kinds of experiences. So stress, experience of stress, social minority stress, stigma, all the psychological studies which address this kind of experience. But then the sort of new piece, the piece that you don't see much in psychology, psychological studies, is to bring in theological perspectives. What are theological perspectives on suffering, on the interpretation of suffering, response, and response to suffering? Theological studies that I was particularly interested in, what were the perspectives of sexual minority people themselves? How did sexual minority people themselves understand the sequence of events? What was bubbling up among gay, lesbian, bisexual, and transgender people of faith as they thought about this experience? And what I found was a very wide spectrum of perspectives on these kinds of experiences. What I would call conservative perspectives, so these would be sexual minority people who live within traditional religious communities, Christians, Jews, and even Muslims, as I have some that I found, who live within traditional communities and who understood the task to be to shift some ways of thinking in traditional communities, and then themselves just become integrated into the communities as they exist. All the way to the more radical side, what sort of loosely called queer theologians, who reject almost entirely traditional communities, traditional understandings of the divine, and argue that there is no place for sexual minority people in traditional communities. Those must be radically reconstructed or rejected altogether. And so these are the spectrums of a very wide range of understandings of what should be done in response to experiencing heterosexism or religious heterosexism. And the conversation among these people is extremely vivid right now and chaotic. And there's no real consensus on what should happen, because the experience of finding a life of faith as a sexual minority person, at least as a public conversation, is relatively new. So there's a lot of chaos. So this is very much of relevance to me as a person in clinical practice, because people come to my office all the time, sexual minority people all the time, and present themselves as people of faith of some kind, either on the conservative side or on the more radical side, or they come in a lot of turmoil about where they fit on the spectrum and are wanting to find out. And so it's interesting to me intellectually, but it's also very compelling as a clinician as I begin to try to work with someone about how they can find a place for themselves on this spectrum. It's not purely an intellectual question, it's also a clinical question. And while the intellectual question can be entertaining and compelling, and I can tolerate the waiting to know, but how is it going to unfold? In the clinical moment, you can't really wait, because people need to know right then, because they're suffering in that moment, not as an abstract concept, but right in front of you. And they need assistance, they need help in figuring out where they're going to fit on the spectrum. The way that I tried to address this clinical problem was to step back and and to think more systematically, to use more systematic theology, to think about how is it that religious symbols work in people's lives? Why would sexual minority people who have experienced such rejection and so much prejudice from traditional religion, why would they be religious at all? Why would they find themselves longing to be part of a religious community? This is an interesting question. What is it that makes people religious? How is it that the religious symbols, which have been used in very painful and hurtful ways to denigrate, how can they still be powerful in the lives of gay, lesbian, bisexual people? I have no thoughts on that. So this is something I'm interested in looking at. I think that so I think what I'll do now is I'm just going to talk about the variables that I used in the empirical part of the research, and I'm going to talk about the ways that the variables relate. So I told you about the different stages in the coping, in the process of coping: suffering, interpretation, response, and then outcomes. And I'm going to tell you about the ways that I operationalized those variables, how I made them into discrete variables that people could be measured on instruments. The experience of suffering was operationalized as a variable called heterosexist religious stress. And I constructed a scale with the help of a focus group of sexual minority people of faith to reflect as many heterosexist religious stressors as I could. The scale was a collation of all the various kinds of stressful religious experiences, like, for example, being excommunicated, being assaulted, being told they are not welcome, a whole variety of stressors. And compiled those into a scale. And my hypothesis was that the more stressors, the higher number of stressors that people experience, or the higher salience of the stressors in their lives, would be correlated with negative outcomes. So with psychological distress, that over time, the accumulation of heterosexist religious stressors would have an impact on the psychological and the religious well-being of subjects. And I base that on the literature, which does find a correlation between the experience of social stress or stigma and psychological outcome. Most of the literature. There is a small bit of literature which says that there is no relationship because there are mediating variables which impact that. So, but most of the literature does find the correlation. So I expected to find the correlation between these two variables. And in fact, I did not find the correlation. In the research that I did, if you look at table one, these are the results, you can see that there is no correlation between the psychological outcome, which I use, which is depression, and different aspects of depression. No correlation between the experience of stress. Now, the meaning of this is not self-evident. It's not quite clear what this means. This could be an artifact of the sample. It's possible that it has to do with the people that I sampled in my research. I think that part of the scale that I used had a place for people to write sort of qualitative responses. And what became clear to me reading the responses, the qualitative responses of the subjects, was that the people that ended up responding to this research, this request for subjects, were people who seemed to have gone through a lot of work to relocate themselves in some kind of faith tradition. These were not people who were just starting their faith journey. These people had really struggled over time to find a place for themselves in some kind of faith experience. And so it seems that it's possible that this lack of correlation between the number of stressors that people experienced and depression has to do with that the work that people have done. And it would be interesting in future research to try to differentiate between where, differentiate between people who were sort of early in their faith journey and people who had really been, had spent a long time figuring out where they could place themselves. But what the data does tell us is that there is no necessary relationship between people who experience a lot of distress in religious communities and depression. That psychological well-being is not necessarily affected, at least among this sample, by the experience of this kind of stress. I was very surprised by this, I didn't expect it. On the same table, if you look down under the depression variables, you can see the two additional dependent variables, stress-related growth and satisfaction with life, and then below that, religious growth or satisfaction. Now, I was very surprised to find that the higher the experience of heterosexual stress, the more heterosexual stress that people experience, religious heterosexual stress, the more likely it was that they would experience a sense of growth as a result of that. Isn't that interesting? So the more stressful their experiences had been, the more likely it was that they would experience growth as a result of that. That's a positive outcome. And then in terms of the religious variable, religious growth satisfaction, a similar result, more modest, but similar. The more religious stressors people experienced, the more likely it was that they experienced a subjective sense of religious growth. So that the experience of the stress, rather than tearing people down, seemed to be an opportunity for some kind of positive experience. So these results require further refinement, but it's an interesting initial finding. And it's consistent with some of the anecdotal or autobiographical writings that are available among sexual minority theologians and also just general people of faith, that the experience of the negative value of distress enables something to happen. Now, this is not necessarily universally true. It's just for this population. So that's outcome. That's along the suffering interpretation, coping, and outcome. Heterosexual stress, suffering, and depression is outcome. There are two other steps along the way that I mentioned. One of those steps is response. How do people respond to heterosexual stress? What do they do after they experience it? And Dr. Hummel mentioned that there's a growing body of literature on coping, and particularly religious coping. How do people use religion to cope with life experiences, negative life experiences? And this is particularly interesting for this population because religion is implicated in the stress itself, in the suffering. It's the religion that is, in some sense, causing the suffering. So then, what would it look like for people to use religion in response to the suffering? There hasn't really been any research that has thought about, in COVID, has thought about religion as the actual stressor. It's usually the opposite. So I wanted to look at the two kinds of religious coping that have been identified by people like Ken Parkman. Positive religious coping. Positive religious coping is the kind of coping which tends to eventuate in a positive psychological outcome. So people use religious coping activities which are correlated with well-being. And then there's negative religious coping. Negative religious coping are other kinds of religious symbols and means which tend to eventuate in negative outcomes. So higher levels of depression, greater mortality, etc. So there is a growing body of literature on these kinds of coping. I applied the instruments to measure this kind of coping to this population. And what I found was that in general, that the coping scales applied to this population reflect the general population, that negative religious coping eventuated in a negative outcome, in this case depression, and that positive religious coping eventuated in a positive outcome as it would with the general population. So in this case with a sense of positive affect and with growth and with religious satisfaction. So basically it's that finding supports the idea that even though religion is implicated in the suffering itself, it is nevertheless available to people as a resource and as a positive resource. And that was consistent. There are other ways of measuring coping besides positive and negative. There are also different coping styles. The three different coping styles which have been identified in literature are kind of style which is called self-directing. Self-directing is a kind of religious style where a person sort of feels that God has given them, or the transcendent has given them the abilities to solve problems, and they kind of go off on their own to solve their problems. It's collaborative coping. Collaborative is a way that people tend to partner up with the divine, partner up with God, and so to shoulder their problems, and deferring coping. Deferring coping is kind of coping where people sort of give everything up to God and let God handle everything. And in general, the findings in the larger literature about which styles tend to be more effective were consistent with this, which is that the self-directing and the collaborative coping tend to be more useful kinds of coping than other styles of coping. Now, the part of this research that I think was the most interesting to me was the interpretive moment. So I said that there was suffering, interpretation, coping, and outcome. The interpretive moment is how people make sense of the religion, the heterosexual religious stress. How do people understand what happened to them? I'm very interested in, like I said, how people are religious and the styles that people use to be religious. And I wondered if there were different ways of interpreting religious symbols which would be more or less useful in coping with heterosexual religious stress. And I developed styles from some of the literature. I developed four different styles. The first style was called a conserving style. Conserving style is a style of religiosity in which people tend to take religious symbols and sort of make use of them in a conventional sense. So this would be sexual minority people who would take the whole variety of religious symbols around sexuality and understand them as they have traditionally been understood, so that same-sex behavior, sexual behavior is wrong or bad. That would be a conserving style, preserving the original sense of the symbol. A second style is called reconstruction style. Reconstruction style is to take traditional symbols, but then to break the meaning and to reinvent the symbol. So to take traditional Jewish or Christian symbols, but to create something new out of them. The third style is the replacing style. That involves rejecting traditional symbols and adopting new and alternative symbols. So this would take the form in this culture of these, say, becoming pagan or adopting a Buddhist perspective, if you don't have that background. That's a replacing style. Replaces traditional symbols with new symbols. And finally, the rejecting style. Rejecting style is saying religious symbols and religious meanings have no value. They mean nothing to me as a sexual minority person, and they're best gotten rid of. And I wondered, and these are hypothesized styles and don't exist in nature. They kind of bubbled out from the reading that I did. But I wondered if I created this typology and I forced people to choose, would there be some styles, would one of these styles or more than one be more effective than other styles? And that is, again, a very important clinical question, as I said, because when someone's in your office, you're trying to help them figure out where to locate themselves. This is something that can be important to know. This is on table four. What I found was what I thought anecdotally would be the case, which is that the most positive response, the most positive outcome, comes from the reconstructing style. This is people who take traditional religious symbols from their environment, and they break the symbols and they rework them to have new meaning. So this is, people from Christian or Jewish communities or others that would continue to use the same symbols that they'd always been using, but to give them new meaning. And that was the most, the highest amount of positive outcome was related to that style. What I was surprised about was that I thought that the replacing style is the style people exchange traditional symbols for unusual symbols like pagan symbols or Buddhist symbols. I thought that would be related to a very positive outcome too, but it seemed to me intuitively that would help people to feel quite empowered and that they were sort of taking their religious life into their own hands. But what I found actually was that was not the case, that the outcomes were not particularly good for people who chose that style, that the correlations were not to psychological or religious well-being. And that surprised me a great deal. How I came to understand that was that I suspect that for people who use the replacing style, while the new symbols are intellectually satisfying, while they feel kind of freed up from the oppression of more traditional symbols, that they can. And I remember your caveat that this is not universally the case, but in general, they can feel sort of cut off from the richness that religious symbols have when they're offered through a community of faith as opposed to a more intellectual experience. And that people who use the replacing style perhaps were not able to have the kind of richness, the layered meanings that you find in faith communities. The rejecting symbol style also was not correlated with particularly good outcome. Those people also did not experience a sense of growth. None of the correlations pointed to a good psychological result. But the reconstruction style did, and that is consistent, I think, with theological perspectives, which understand how religious symbols function, and that is to say that they function in community. That the meaning of religious symbols is not self-evident, but is mediated through the practice of religious community. This is not to say that people who adopt the replacing style couldn't find those meanings, but that it's more difficult when they're decontextualized and they're sort of uprooted in their culture. Now, that again, this is true for this sample, and you have to be careful how we generalize, because the sample that I used was not a random sample, but a convenient sample. So that means that the people who were part of the study, who want to be part of the study, so that does skew the results. But at the same time, I think that this question of how people are religious and how they make use of religious symbols is a larger question. It's particularly a pointed question for gay and gay people, because the relationship between sexual people and the symbols is such a rocky relationship, and that sexual people have to think about religious symbols in ways that non-gay people often do not, because of the ways in which the symbols have been used and have affected them personally. I want to say two things about theology, the theological moments of the study. I said earlier that I'm very concerned with making a case for psychology and the social sciences to have to address theology and the theological disciplines on their own terms. And that's very difficult to do. But I think that there are moments, and they have particularly to do with interpretation and research, when even social scientists can be invited to imagine what it would be like to interpret theologically. I was saying earlier that one of the bodies of literature that I looked at was, what are the writings of sexual minority people themselves? How are they articulating and describing their faith experiences? Whether that's gay, lesbian theologians, or a lot of autobiographical materials coming out now about how people have kind of survived their religious experience as sexual minority people. Those are theological moments, opportunities to see how interpretation is happening. And psychologists do need to be invited to look at that kind of material, not just empirical studies, but also how is this kind of qualitative data being interpreted? That's the job of practical theology, to look at this kind of materials in these faith lives. And the other theological moment in this kind of work is trying to understand this data, because this data has theological horizons. It's not just interpreted psychologically, but there are theological meanings which hover around the outside. Why do the results come out this way? Why is the reconstructionist style, at least among this population, why do these subjects tend to have better psychological outcomes? What's the theological reason for that? Well, I was talking a little bit about how symbols work. It possibly has to do with the way that religious symbols function in community. Why does the rejecting style not work? Why is the outcome for the rejecting style so negative? What are the reasons, the theological reasons? So these are the two moments, I think, when theology can be invited in. How do we make meaning? I think that social scientists and psychologists are always making theological arguments. They're making philosophical interpretations, they're making meaning interpretations. They don't understand that, they're not explicit about it. And so what I think theology has to offer to social sciences is to point out when that's happening. When is the hermeneutic being exercised? When is an interpretive moment unfolding, although it's being presented as objective? In fact, it's actually hermeneutic. So, let's see how long I'm talking. Nope. Long enough.
Keep going.
Yeah.
Keep going if you want.
Okay. I don't really want to. so much. I wonder
if you want to... Well, why don't we take a moment then, and thank you.